welcome to episode 16 of Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast, The Naughty 90s. I'm Jerry Shario, and with me here is an actor, director, playwright, musician, author, a truly unique individual, just like everybody else, Nick Santamaria.
You did say unique and not eunuch, right?
I did, yes. I made sure I put the emphasis on the proper syllable, yeah.
Thank you very much, because I'm a cut above. You almost put on bumped.
I almost did. I almost stopped myself.
I heard you stopped mid-bump.
I didn't want to make it a grind. I'm sorry.
Oh, my God. And we are talking about burlesque comedians, so that does...
Yes, we are.
Right in. Talk about a segue. Boy, that was good.
Oh, boy.
So today we're talking about a movie called The Naughty 90s, which to me sounds like a porno film for old people. They are naughty, those people in their 90s.
Oh, yeah.
And... Well, let's start out by welcoming my good friend and cohort on this fabulous podcast, Mr. Jerry Shario. How you doing,
pal? Hello there. I'm doing well, sir. I'm doing well.
Good.
Trying to keep my head above water here, but you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's better. You don't say that to somebody in Florida, you know?
True. However, you know, we got our first snowfall here last night in lovely Spokane, Washington.
Washington.
Well, thankfully, you know, about between 8 and 9 p.m., it started really coming down. But when I woke up this morning and looked out the window, you'd never know anything had happened.
Really?
Yeah.
So it was one of those light snows that melted as soon as the sun showed its face.
I'm guessing, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, well.
But it's portent of what is to come.
I went camping with a portent once, and boy, was it bad. I couldn't get the zipper to work, nothing. But anyway, so yeah, things here are status quo, I might say, and we are definitely, holidays are already upon us.
Oh, I mean, my gosh, yes.
Halloween started Christmas, basically. I mean,
yeah.
You know, and I have a lot of friends who say, oh, yeah, we love that. We love the earlier the better, you know, the earlier the better. To me, it just makes the actual holiday less special. You know
it
what
does.
I mean?
When it really up. Does. You know, a wonderful job that I had. I worked 6 years at a local radio station here in town. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, live and local, and it was great. The one major thing that I hated about the job was that we started planning for Christmas in August.
Oh, my God.
Which you have to do. You know,
I know,
radio. You're going to have promotions and programs and things. And so you have mm-hmm. to. But it just bugged me to pieces to think about Christmas that early.
Well, I mean, it is. It's weird. It's just really weird. Where do you dredge up the spirit at, you know, during August? You know,
yeah.
You're sweating. You're building sweat men on your front lawn.
Yes.
You know? So, okay. So let's get down to the subject at hand. And
yes.
That is the film called The Naughty 90s, as I mentioned before. They started shooting it after the holidays. Now, I have a funny story. Most Abbott and Costello fans know this story. But for those of you who are among the uninitiated, Christmas was Lou Costello's personal holiday. He claimed it as his own. And for years, I lived right around the corner from his house on Longridge Avenue. I could have walked it, you know, and I used to. I used to go and just look at it. But what he did every year was create traffic problems around his house because people would come from miles around to see his house decorated. Now, there was a mechanical Santa Claus on the roof with mechanical reindeer. There was a big screen on the front lawn showing cartoons on a loop for kids. You know, it was just a big display. It was just huge. And every year it would be the same thing, the traffic. Well, George Gobel, the comedian, bought the house across the street. And in true George Gobel understated fashion, he had on his mailbox one light bulb with a note reading, "See our display across the street." It doesn't get any better than that.
Oh, no.
But there is a story that the Universal guys, the Universal crew, used to come and decorate the house for him. And one year he was late at the studio and his family lit the lights before he got home, and he wouldn't speak for like 2 days afterwards. He was so upset that he didn't get to do it. So that's what I mean, man. As a kid at Christmas. And of course, he sent his minions out with baskets for people who couldn't afford dinner and all that stuff. He did that every Thanksgiving and every Christmas. Anyway, and Bud, too. They were both very charitable men, very, very kind, charitable men. So that's my Christmas story. And after New Year's, they started shooting this January 14th, 1945. Now, 1945 is very interesting for one main reason. Abbott and Costello are pretty much known today as the team that helped us get through World War II, right? Mm-hmm. Their best years, people always say, are the World War II years. I don't always agree, but they started out right around Pearl Harbor. And now this is, they're shooting until July 1945. So it's the beginning and the end, you know, of the war. Yeah. But interestingly, with the end of the war, their popularity started waning a little bit. They started noticing a little less at the box office, and there were some things that needed to be done to help, you know, get rid of that problem. But here's what's interesting about this movie. First of all, why were Abbott and Costello slipping? It's because they were overexposed, and I mean like ridiculously so. Universal would make, you know, 10 movies a year. They made so many Abbott and Costello movies. They just wanted to keep the cash rolling in. MGM was releasing their movies as well. At the same time, Universal was releasing their movies. And they were on radio every week. They were doing personal appearances in theaters. And they were, you know, they were everywhere. You couldn't spit without hitting Abbott and Costello. So, not that you'd want to. But this movie kind of represents the start of the slide, and they started experimenting after this film. The reason I'm bringing this up is because my co-author on the annotated Abbott and Costello, Matthew Conium, mentioned that, and I've heard a few people say this since then, their next films for Universal were departures from their norm. It's Little Giant and The Time of Their Lives. In these two movies, they separated the boys. They played separate roles. They were not a team. In fact, they were in very few scenes together during that time. And that was all because they needed something different. And Lou kind of put this into play with the executives. We've got to do something different. So this, Matthew Conium said, this was the first film where they weren't officially a team, which I don't really get. I thought about it, and I thought to myself, okay, maybe they're right. You know, Bud's the star of the show. He plays Dexter Broadhurst, the leading man in the Showboat show. And Lou is part of the orchestra, part of the backstage crew. He did everything. You know, he was the general factotum. So here's another thing I did, and I noticed for the very first time, we were talking about stuff that we've noticed before we started the podcast, and Lou makes his entrance. He's holding a bass drum on his stomach, and it's strapped to his back. And his entrance is he trips and he rolls over the drum, picks himself up, and looks at us and says,
"I rolled over."
He talks to us quite a bit in this movie. But yes, if you go back and play it and you watch Lou doing this fall, you hear Bud in the background go, "Sebastian!" Those three syllables tell me that Bud got the part as the star and his partner Lou got, you know, a lesser role. So he knew him. He knew him enough to say, "Hey, Sebastian." So I don't agree. I don't agree with that assessment. They were a team. They knew each other, because in the very next scene, they're Abbott and Costello, like they've never changed. So anyway, I'd like to shoot that out of the sky as far as theory. Sorry, Matthew, I love you, but So let's look at the players. Let's look at the team. And strange as it may seem, they give players. Oh, no, that's
not. Say, not yet.
Sorry,
not yet.
Sorry. I'm holding back. Okay. The cork came out. I had to. So we have our two-time Abbott and Costello director, Gene Yarborough, who the guys really liked, by the way. He's directing for the third time. I like to call him Mr. Pacing, because he really keeps movies moving, which is what they should do. The writers, okay, this was supposed to be if you go back, you have Buck Privates, right? Their first starring film. Mm-hmm. Then there was supposed to be Hold That Ghost. And then there was supposed to be this movie. But it wasn't. The first script, the first treatment was by Edmund Joseph. And it was Hal Finberg. Now, Hal Finberg, you'll remember, was a writer on The Big Store for the Marx Brothers, and he was kind of exclusively a writer of special material for the Ritz Brothers, worked for them for years. So he was in on this from the beginning, but since it wasn't made in 1941 or 42, they gave another pass on the script. They gave it to Edmund Hartman, who wrote, you know, a few of their recent movies, and John Grant, of course, who is now co-producing with Edmund Hartman and unbilled Milton Feld. I don't know why he didn't get a credit. He was also a producer. But they brought on two gag men, one billed and one not, and for good reason. Felix Adler, the great comedy writer, not the famous clown, he wrote a lot of the two-reeler stuff in this movie. There's a lot of two-reeler stuff, and you'll know what I mean when we get there. But also Clyde Bruckman was uncredited, and he added a few things that everything was taken away. And the only thing I recognize is one gag, and again, it was stolen from Harold Lloyd. Now, we talked about this, Clyde Bruckman, a tragic story. He became an alcoholic. He started repeating himself, stealing from himself, but actually stealing from Harold Lloyd, who owned the material that Clyde Bruckman wrote. Harold Lloyd was a real jerk about it. He sued everybody, and he ruined the life of Clyde Bruckman. But anyway, so he added something, and once we get to that scene, I'll tell you what it was and why it was taken out. Okay, so those are our script writers. They're all wonderful guys. And then we have the songwriters in this, and there's only one original song. Now, in most movies in those days, they like to put an original song in because it could be a whole new cash cow, you know, if it becomes a hit. And they put a 1940s song into a movie that takes place in the 1890s. But it's okay. It works because it kind of has the flavor, you know? I can't get you out of my mind. Anyway, we'll get to that. Those were written by Jack Brooks and Edgar Fairchild. Now, Jack Brooks, this is interesting. Jack Brooks wrote the lyrics for Old Buttermilk Sky, the great Hoagie Carmichael song. Yeah. He also wrote the lyrics for That's Amore. Now, this is interesting to me because I always assumed that Harry Warren, who wrote the music for the song, had something to do with the lyrics because Harry Warren was actually Italian, probably the only Italian songwriter on Tin Pan Alley. And I thought, how perfect, That's Amore. But then I found out later that Dean Martin hated the song and that the lyrics are so hokey, and they were written by Jack Brooks, who wasn't Italian. So it kind of makes sense. And it became Dean's first million seller, believe it or not. And interestingly, he also wrote for Jerry Lewis in Cinderfella, one of the worst songs I've ever heard. Let me be a people, not a VIP. I don't want to be anybody else but plain old me. I'm going to wipe a little vomit. Hold on. Okay. you know what happens in your mouth sometimes? You know. And Edgar Fairchild, I'm sorry to say, his I think his most famous song was I Can't Get You Out of My Mind from this movie. And then there's three other songs, and we'll get to those when we get to them. Okay, so Naughty 90s.
Yes.
Bob Thomas's book, Bud and Lou, which is an excoriating, is that how you pronounce it? Excoriating.
I believe so.
Book. Yeah, ruining reputations.
And even if it's not the proper way to pronounce it for his book, it's good enough.
He had Eddie Sherman behind him, who obviously had a bone to pick with the boys because, boy, did he.
Yeah.
He really threw them under the bus. But anyway, the story has it that the opening titles say Bud Abbott and Lou Costello, you know, Bud on top, Lou on the bottom. Yeah. And in the little O's, you know, for Costello and Abbott, Lou pops up first out of the O, and you see him mouth, hey, Abbott, right? And all of a sudden, Bud pops up in his O in Abbott, and scares Lou, and the two of them kind of flinch and look at each other, and that dissolves into the title, The Naughty 90s. Bob mm-hmm. Thomas made us believe that Lou created a snit on the set. I will not have him pop up first. I will pop up first. It's kind of like going back to the ridiculous idea of him wanting to call it Costello and Abbott. I don't believe any of it, and nor should yeah. you, because it's just sensationalism and, you know, trying to make him look bad. So anyway, it's a very cute opening, the way they do that. Mm-hmm. And the opening scene to me is very interesting. It shows, you know, the banks of the Mississippi, and we see a showboat going down the Mississippi. And there's a dock where all these guys are lifting the bales of hay and everything, and they're singing a song, you know, about the showboat coming. And I noticed for the first time that they are superimposed over that film clip of the showboat going. So yes. they're not actually there. Yeah. You can see the outline.
Yes, this was the first time I noticed it as well. And after watching this film, I don't know how many times. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Isn't it interesting? Yeah, there's a few things I noticed for the first time in this movie. The showboat itself is a model. And I think it's one of the best models I've ever seen, because I, mm-hmm. for the first time, noticed that it was a model. And again, like Jerry, I've been watching this movie since I was knee high to a pie. What else is slapstick? to a cream pie.
There you go.
Yeah. But they were smart enough to save the portion of the showboat that they built for Showboat. Universal made what is considered the best version of Showboat in 1936. And now, mm-hmm. 9 years later, they're using it again, and it works beautifully. There are some shots in this movie, some dolly shots following mm-hmm. the action, like in the gambling casino. It's mm-hmm. forever. It's like a Martin Scorsese shot. And when I say shot in his movies, you never know.
Yeah.
So we see the showboat. We see it coming in, and Captain Sam is played by Henry Travers. Now, dear old Henry Travers, born in 1874 in Prudhoe, Northumberland, England, to two Irish immigrants. And he appeared in some great movies. I mean, most notably, It's a Wonderful Life as the Angel. And he was also in Mrs. Miniver. He was in, so many movies. I have to get my notes here. Bells of St. Mary's, It's a Wonderful Life, The Invisible Man, and one of my favorite Hitchcock movies, maybe in my top three, Shadow of a Doubt. Just incredible movie. And he's an incredible actor. With eyebrows you could sleep on. They're just huge. He would come up and hit people in the face with them. Those are big eyebrows. You got to. Those are big eyebrows to follow. So yeah, and his real name, by the way, was Travers Hegarty. Doesn't get much more Irish than that. He passed away in 1965, by the way, at the age of 91. It pays to be an angel, you know. So Captain Sam comes out and he's greeting the people who, you know, it's a family show. It's a family operation. Everybody loves the showboat. Everyone loves Captain Sam. And he introduces his lovely daughter, and she's played by Lois Collier. Now, Lois Collier, she started out in Worcester, Massachusetts. And I'm looking for my notes, if you'll excuse me one second. Yes, 1917 she was born, and she wasn't born in Worcester. She was born in Sally, South Carolina. Sally, South Carolina, that's like a nickname. And she started out in Westerns, eventually went to Universal, where she started making woman pictures. Now, I'm not talking about Betty Davis or Joan Crawford pictures. I'm talking about Weird Woman, Cobra Woman, Jungle Woman. Those are woman pictures for Universal.
Okay.
So she got onto the Universal horror merry-go-round and did quite well with that. She passed away in 1999, by the way. She lived a nice long life. So yeah, so he introduces her, and then he introduces the leading man of the big showboat show, and that's Bud Abbott, looking better than he ever looked before. He's playing heartthrob leading man Dexter Broadhurst, my favorite name for Bud. And he comes out, Dexter Broadhurst. And he comes out, he takes a bow, and they cut to three young ladies whose eyes are fluttering and their hearts are alight with romance and dreams of love with Bud. But the interesting thing was, and I wonder if this bothered Bud, they were three of the homeliest women on that dock. Sorry, go back and look at the scene. They did not go to the, you know, the Universal Chorus Girls for this one. And I don't even know if they put out a casting notice, wanted, three women who find Bud Abbott attractive. I don't know. I really don't know. So anyway, I just thought it was funny.
On a related note, and further down the line here, the song, I Can't Get You Out of My Mind. Yeah. The main thing I noticed, not only does she sing it well, but the three guys that are backing her up all look like they're about 50 years old.
I have that note here. And I say exactly that. It's like they're 50.
Yeah.
You know? Well, a lot of the chorus boys were in the Army.
Yes.
And the Navy and the Marines, you know?
And so does this mean that the chorus girls also were? And that's why we've got these three at the beginning? I don't know. I don't know if it's connected or not.
But they all looked like, you know, they were ready for their tonic.
Yes.
It was really something. I love that I wrote the exact same thing. That's amazing. Okay. Then we meet Lou. And Lou, like I said, he comes out on with his drum. He does this, this grand entrance, rolling over on the drum. He's really talking to us in this movie. We are his partner in this movie. He talks a lot. But anyway, our villains are watching this whole thing from a carriage, and good old John Hamilton, Perry White from the old Superman show, he plays the sheriff, and he's escorting the three crooks out of town. Now, the three crooks are played by, I got to tell you, two of my favorites. One is Alan Curtis. Now, we remember him from Buck Privates. He was the angry chauffeur and, you know, leading man there. And here he is one of the three crooks, one of the three bandits who are going to take over the showboat eventually. Interestingly, about Alan Curtis, I mentioned this in the Buck Privates, and I'll say it very quickly. He worked uncredited in Hollywood for a few years until Joan Crawford saw him and got a little woohoo excited and introduced him all around and got him his first real part in a movie called Mannequin. And from there he started working, but he had an ego problem and he eventually was let go and was, you know, relegated to Universal playing, you know, second rate parts. Sadly, he died from a botched kidney operation when he was just like 43 years old. He had the operation. He died for 4 minutes. His heart stopped for 4 minutes. They revived him. But 5 days later, he died. He died of complications. Yeah, very sad. And even more sad for Rita Johnson. Now, I don't know if you're a fan of Rita Johnson or if you know who she is, but I absolutely have been a fan since I was a little kid. Not only did I find her incredibly attractive, but number two, nobody plays a sneaky bitch. Sorry, like Rita Johnson. She's usually the other woman in a comedy situation. Other woman meaning the one who doesn't get the guy at the end. There were a few actresses that had that, and they played it constantly. Gail Patrick was one. Helen Vinson was another one. Natalie Moorhead was another. But Rita Johnson was the one for the 40s, for the 1940s. I loved her in The Big Clock with Charles Laughton. She annoys him to the point where he kills her in cold blood. It's really quite harrowing. But she was born in Worcester, Massachusetts. It was her. She's trying to.
There you go.
Yeah, 1913. She died in 1965. Unusual circumstances. In 1948, she got a brain injury. She was in a coma for 2 weeks. She said that an industrial size hair dryer fell on her head and knocked her out and caused brain damage. People like Walter Winchell and Dorothy Kilgallen and all the gossip mongers were saying that it was spousal abuse and she was just trying to hide it. But this ruined her life. She played a few other parts, mostly sitting down because she was somewhat paralyzed. and she eventually gave up the ghost in 1965. From what I understand, she was also an alcoholic. But anyway, that's here nor there. She's a wonderful actress, and she's great in this movie. And speaking of which, if I had to give the number three spot in this movie for my favorite performance, it's Joe Sawyer. Yes. Joseph Sawyer had such an affinity with these two guys, with Abbott and Costello. He worked so well with them. He had just done Hit the Ice, where he played again. He played one of three crooks. But in this movie, he is so lively. Screaming, his scream. Nobody screams like Joe Sawyer, you know? There are certain scenes where they're hurting him, and it's amazing. But he's having the time of his life. So yeah, so Joe Sawyer, born in 1906, passed away in 1982. He was born in Ontario, Canada, and passed away in Ashland, Oregon, not far from you, Jerry.
Ah, yes.
of liver cancer, and he was 75 years old. So our three crooks decide they're going to go see the show at the Showboat because they're waiting for, they live in St. Louis. They have to go back to St. Louis, and they're waiting for the boat to take them. So they go see the show. Now, Lou with his drum, okay, he's part of the parade that goes through town to announce the Showboat. And he's the last person in line, and he's hitting the rhythm, the drum in front of him, and he can't see in front of him. Okay, the drum is too high over him. So he's hitting the drum and he's following the band. Eventually the band takes a right and Lou keeps going straight. So he's alone hitting the drum. People are looking at him, horses are getting out of the way. And eventually he walks into a ditch and disappears and falls over. One of the things I wanted to mention is that there's an outtake from this scene. Lou is walking with the thing, and originally he was supposed to walk into a barn full of cows, and that's where he was going to end up at the end of the scene. Unfortunately, two of the cows wanted to get on record their romantic action. How do I put this? they didn't care that we were looking. So they didn't use that.
That would have added somewhat to the naughty part of the naughty 90s, I'm sure. Yeah.
You're absolutely correct. All right. Now, I love this scene. The show is Bud with the sawmill, you know, it's whatever. And he's talking to the leading lady, Lois Collier, and he's acting really big. I must see the man about my invention, and then we will live forever, blah, blah, blah. Okay, Lou is behind the scenes doing the sound effects, and you know, that's just a recipe for disaster. My favorite part is when the snow comes down. The door opens on the set, and it's not supposed to. And he has to come out and close the door. And Bud, of course, is yelling at him, what are you doing? There's a show going on. What are you doing? And he's hammering the door. And of course, the whole thing falls down. Then he moves around and hits the wrong thing. And a ton of snow falls on the stage, ruining the effect, of course. But then we get to the point where there's a baby crying. Actually, there's two babies crying. Mm-hmm. And they're in the front row, of course. And Lou takes a bottle of milk, and he does these wonderful machinations with them, these little tricks he does with his hands where he flips the thing, and I still do them all. I learned from him. And you know something? There's something about people like Lou Costello and Curly Howard. I'm going to mention both of them because both of them have some wonderful shtick. Mm-hmm. That had to be developed during childhood, I have to say. All of those crazy little tricky things that they do,
yeah,
they must have been doing it since they were kids, you know? You can't be that newly dexterous. newly dexterous. Newly dexterous. Oh, my God. it just goes from one thing to another.
But, yes, I will agree with you on that. They are both have such mastery over those little bits of business and shtick things that they do.
Yeah.
It just says they had to have been doing it for years and years and years.
Mm-hmm. And all the sounds and everything else.
Yep.
I mean, it just reeks of childhood. Okay. So the babies are crying, and Lou goes down and he's trying to quiet the babies, and they won't take the bottle. So he takes a rubber glove, blows it up, and pours the milk into the glove and puts pinpricks on two of the fingers and hopes the babies will take them, but neither one does. And I'm wondering if that was kind of a mistake, if they were hoping the babies would do it. But I love the way it fades out. You know, first of all, the ladies holding the babies are completely clueless. They're just staring straight ahead. They're ignoring Lou. They're ignoring the babies. And I'm like, who are they? Bud Abbott? They're just sitting like nothing happened. But it fades out with a really nice shot of one of the babies crying and Lou crying next to the baby. And it just makes sense.
Yes. Yes.
It's really nice. I really like it.
It just makes me wonder if the two mothers were just so enthralled with Mr. Broadhurst up on the stage that they didn't even notice that their babies were screaming like that.
Now, you're going to think I'm sick, but I think one of the funniest parts of this scene, he comes out with a gun first. And he says, "Now quiet, you babies. I'll shoot you." And he points the gun at them. You'd never get away with that today.
No.
And no matter how funny.
Even when he brings out the bottle of milk, his first impulse is to whack him over the head with it.
That's true. You know? Wouldn't you? I mean, think about the time. Think about the times you've flown near a baby. You know, they're a crying baby. Oh, you just wonder. You know, will it fit in the overhead compartment? Okay, so what's important here are the villains are watching the show. Captain Sam finds them there, doesn't recognize them because he knows his clientele, and they play up to him. They flatter him. They invite him, once they get to St. Louis, which they are on their way to come to a party in his honor at the Gilded Cage. Interesting title. And he says, fine, that'll be wonderful. I'd love to come. Thank you very much. Okay, that sets up the plot. So we get to St. Louis and the Gilded Cage. The captain is there already, and they're getting him drunker and drunker and drunker. And he's playing in a very high-stakes card game in the gambling casino. So Bud and Lou realize that they have to get the captain out of there before he's, you know, loses everything. So this is Lou's falls are just incredible. They're just incredible. And this is one of my all-time favorites. They pull up in a carriage, dressed to the nines, top hats, tails, white tie, looking great. Mm-hmm. Bud stands up and tells Lou, "Now do everything that I do." And he takes his cape, he whips one side over, whips the other side over, and then grandly steps down off the carriage. Lou, doing what he does, whips his cape off one side, whips his cape off the other side, steps down, and falls flat on his face. It is such a great fall, and it comes from a height. He's not on the floor. It comes from a height, and he just smashes his face down. It was just incredible. Anyway, so they get to the place, and some of my favorite things happen here. They can't get into the gambling room unless they know someone or somebody knows them. That's the cue for Hollywood drunk Jack Norton to come out of the gambling casino. And Lou takes over. And I thought this was very intelligent. Lou says, "Leave it to me.
My friend, what is the idea of you coming out here and leaving us on the inside?
Did I do that?
You certainly did.
Then come with me. I'll go back in and get you."
So they all get in under that guise. Come on in. I'll try and find you. So they go in. Quick story about Jack Norton. I don't know if I told you this. My dad at the movies in the early 1950s, yes, watching a movie, the lights come up, he turns around, and sitting behind him is Jack Norton. Hollywood drunk. And my father said something, of course, and all of a sudden everyone was around him and he did his drunk act up the aisle and out of the theater, which is just wonderful. But anyway, so he saves them. They get into the gambling casino and they start doing stuff they did in One Night in the Tropics. They do the 50s, 100s, 100s, and then he throws the bill away and he goes, "What's that?" He goes, "Somebody put a buck in there." And they do the, you know, "Put the money in my hand and keep it there," you know, that whole thing. But at the end of that, and I think you agree with me here, Jerry, at the end of that bit, Bud slaps Lou. And it looks like a really hard slap. And Lou does not take it well. He looks at him. He just looks at him. And Bud tries to lighten the situation and gives him a puh, like a pshaw. And Lou goes right up into his face and goes, pshaw, you know, gives him a psh, and turns around and walks away. And I don't know about you guys. I don't know about you, Jerry, but I sensed a little, discomfort there.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, it got that feeling. Mm-hmm. And I wondered, you know, if that actually was what was happening, would it have been left in, you know?
Yeah. And you know what? It might not be. I might be reading more into it than it should be. But my instincts are pretty good when it comes to watching comedians, you know?
Yeah.
But anyway, so yeah, they do that. And then they go over to the roulette table. Now, I love this. They're repeating a bit they did in Rio Rita. And in that movie, they were counting apples, fake apples. Yes. Here.
I'll tell you what you do. You play the same number as I play.
Okay.
I'll play number 20 and you play 22.
Okay. How can you do that?
Why not?
We're going to play the same number?
Same number.
You want me to play 22?
No. I'm going to play 20.
Why? Well,
you play 22.
That's two different numbers. Let's play the same number. Let's play 30.
All right. You play 30 and I'll play 32.
Okay. No!
Well, what do you want to do?
Let's play the same number. You can't play 32 with me. Look,
what do you
let's
want to do?
Both play 33.
All right, here.
33.
Put it on 30. Put
so
it on
what
30.
Happens is Joe Kirk, Lou's brother-in-law, is the croupier. And every time they bet on number 33, the actual roulette ball lands on 33. But then as soon as they look and say, oh, we won, a magnet makes the ball jump to another number. And, you know, it's very, very obvious. There's one shot where they're suspicious and Bud crosses his arms and looks at them suspiciously. And right at that moment, Lou does the same thing. And the two of them, a beautiful picture of the two of them looking suspicious, you know, and that's real teamwork. I love that kind of teamwork.
Yeah.
So anyway, earlier on, one of my favorite jokes, Lou puts gum in his mouth and he's chewing gum. And Bud says,
now it don't look nice chewing gum in that suit.
I'm chewing my mouth.
Well, skip it.
It's a simple, stupid joke, but it always makes me laugh. So luckily, the gum is there. He puts it on number 33 when Joe Kirk, Lou's brother-in-law, isn't looking. And they bet 33 again. The ball lands on the gum and they can't make it jump. So they win their money. So they go over to the table where Captain Sam is drunk and playing very badly, very bad poker. They have to come up with something. I didn't mention Torchy Rand, did I?
No.
As we got to the Gilded Cage, there is a French girl, a very saucy French girl, singing a song called I'd Leave My Happy Home For You.
I'd leave my happy home for you. Ooh, you're the nicest man I ever knew. If you take me and just break me in the business too, oh, I leave my happy home for you, 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 you.
With her French accent, it comes off as, I'd leave my happy home for you. And it's almost like it's too much. I tried to find stuff about her. She made like 5 movies in her life, but I always liked that little segment. Mm-hmm. Now, here I wanted to bring up the songwriters. Now, this is, what's the name of this movie, Jerry?
Naughty 90s.
90s? Yeah. 1890s?
90s, yes. 1890s. Yeah.
The three songs that I'm thinking of were written by Harry von Tilzer in the 1900s. So they were off about 10 years or so. But the songs are great. He wrote that one. He wrote later on, there's an Irish guy singing Nora Malone.
Nora Malone, call me by phone. Number 1, 2, 3, 4, main. Don't forget the number when you slumber. Open your eyes when you arrive. You'll hear the blarney of your Barney. Carney from Killarney, Colleen's our few. There's none like you in that old town of a bone. Mushawarawarawarawara, old Erin's Isle. Could not make me smile without Nora Malone.
Yep. He wrote that one. And he also wrote another one. What was it? On a Sunday afternoon in the merry
month. Sunday afternoon in the merry month of June. Take a trip up the Hudson or down the bay. Take a trolley to Coney or Rockaway.
the lover's fool.
She sings that, Lois Collier sings that near the beginning. Okay, we're at a gambling casino. So Bud and Lou have to come up with an idea here. They have to get the captain out of that gambling casino before he loses everything. So what do? There's an animal act, and there's a dressing room for the animal act. And the name of the act is the Cristellos. Not the Cristillos, which is Lou's real last name, or the Costellos, which is the name he changed. Cristellos. Anyway, it must have been an inside joke, of course. And the trick is, Abbott says, listen, here's a bear costume. I'll get into the bear costume. You run into the gambling casino and yell that the bear is loose. I'll show up and, you know, everyone will leave. So that's their plan. And of course, you know, what happens? The real bear gets loose. Mm-hmm. Bud hides and Lou thinks the real bear is Abbott and he's hitting it and he's trying to take the head off and all this stuff. The problem with this bit, not only is it one of the first bits that Clark and McCullough did at the turn of the century, like 1898, I'm not kidding, yeah. In burlesque, this was one of their bits. Mm. And Bud and Lou are doing it here, you know, 47 years later. And I guess after 47 years, it might be considered new at this time. But here's what was supposed to happen. This was not the first choice for what was supposed to happen. Mm-hmm. Clyde Bruckman, the master of stealing from himself, he developed a sequence for Harold Lloyd in 1925 or 6, The Freshman, Harold Lloyd's college mm-hmm. comedy, football comedy. Now, in this movie, Harold Lloyd goes into the restroom. He takes off his formal jacket, hangs it up so he could wash up, and a magician comes in and takes the wrong coat and leaves the magic coat for Harold. And he doesn't know he has a different coat on. Mm-hmm. And as he's dealing with people at the party, rabbits are coming out of his sleeves, you know, all kinds of magic tricks are happening around him. And it really is quite hilarious. So he repeated that in a movie called Movie Crazy, which was a talking Harold Lloyd movie, probably his mm-hmm. best. And they did the same sequence. So what does he do? 13 years later, he hands it to Bud and Lou. And Lou, this was the idea. Bud tells Lou, now you put on that cop costume and you run in and you tell everyone, oh, there's gambling and blah, 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 blah. Well, what happens is while he's putting on the cop hat and the little mustache, you know, disguise, the magician comes in and they do the switch and they actually filmed it. They filmed this entire sequence. And I would kill to see it. I would kill to see Lou's version, you know?
Yes.
But they heard from Harold Lloyd's lawyers and they switched to the bear idea, which is really a shame.
Well, first of all, that explains a still or two that I have seen from this movie of Lou in the white tie and tails with the old police helmet.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, that explains that.
And he's got a brush mustache, too.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But then Clyde Bruckman obviously didn't learn his lesson because the Stooges did this. Curly did this. The mm-hmm. title of the film is escaping me at the moment. But same bit, same routine. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I always say this when I talk about Buster Keaton. There's a limit to the well of creativity. There's a limit for everyone, you know, even Chaplin. You know, there's a wall you eventually hit. And you could only do so much in your lifetime, come up with original stuff. And none of them did. None of them. They all reached a certain point and then relied on older stuff. So, that was Clyde Bruckman. He was desperate, you know? He was desperate. So that's a shame. Anyway, they do the bear thing. And I'm not crazy about it because the bear looks so phony. Yeah. There's no danger involved. There's, you know, it's not like Chaplin in the circus in the cage with a live lion, you know.
Oh, yes.
You've got tension, you know, and it builds and it's funny. This is a man in a bear suit, you know, who just got out of the Jeep from Ride 'em Cowboy. you know, and it's just not, I don't know.
It even works better in Africa Screams. You know, it's the same gag. Bud's mm-hmm. going to put on the lion skin and get in the cage with Lou. But they use, you know, rear projection of an actual lion. And it works better there than it does here with this chintzy bear costume.
Without a doubt. I totally agree with you. And it does work better in Africa Screams and even in their television show, the live show. They do the same mm-hmm. thing. So, yeah, that kind of hurts, I think. It hurts the bit. So let's see where we're at. I'm so sorry. This movie is so, what's the word I'm looking for? Episodic?
Yes.
It goes from one routine to the next, then a plot thing, then a routine, plot thing, you know. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, one of the things I noticed, and tell me if you noticed this, Jerry, the Captain Sam, mm-hmm. apparently had a gambling problem.
Yes.
Right? They mention it.
Yes.
In the movie. And I never noticed that before. He was obviously going in with a gambling problem. And there was one other thing that I noticed like that, and it was very unusual. Yes, before I forget, later on, there's a scene, one of my favorite scenes in the movie, where Joe Sawyer is sleeping, and Bud and Lou mm-hmm. are looking for his wallet in his room, and he keeps waking up and having a nightmare about the general and these Indians and this and that. It's mentioned in an earlier scene. Alan Curtis says to him, "What are you, having your nightmares during the day now? I thought you had them at night." I never noticed that before. So Captain Sam had a gambling problem and Joe Sawyer had a nightmare problem. So there you go.
Okay.
they certainly didn't make it like, you know, overt. You have to really look and listen. Oh boy. Okay. So everybody left the casino when the guy in the bear costume showed up. But unfortunately, the captain lost 3/4 of the showboat. So yep. Now he has 3 partners who actually own the lion's share of the boat. So that's the plot. They're going to put gambling casino on the River Queen. That's the name of the boat. And the captain is beside himself. He can't believe he did this. So anyway, they are on the ship now. They are now part of the picture, the big picture. So Bud and Lou are on the deck looking down at the dock, and he's watching the 3 villains, you know, deal with Captain Sam and then come onto the boat. Before they get onto the boat, Bud says, "You've got to do something. You've got to keep them off this boat." And Lou takes on a very brave countenance, saying, "I'm not afraid of anything. I can take care of whatever. I'm blah, blah, blah." He turns around, and Sam McDaniel, who is Hattie McDaniel's brother, playing a character named Matt, but Bud and Lou ignored it and just called him Sam through the whole movie. Yeah. and Sam is great. Sam McDaniel is fantastic. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Made more movies than his sister. But he's plucking chickens, dead chickens, next to Bud and Lou. So when Lou does this grand, I'm not afraid of anything, I can do it, he turns around and he walks right into a dead chicken, his face. And he gets really scared, and it's really funny. And I wrote in my book, in the annotated Abbott and Costello, that it's 10 times funnier than the caterpillar joke in Animal Crackers. And, yeah. You know, you're the bravest man in Africa. Oh, caterpillar. Oh. It just comes off as so phony. But this is hilarious. So anyway, he goes down with 2 guns. He's dressed as a cowboy. And he goes down to meet Joe Sawyer and Rita Johnson. And telling them he's 2-Gun Sebastian, which was his father's name, by the way. Mm-hmm. And he's got his guns, and he's saying, "You can't come on. I'm a crack shot. I'll shoot you." And he looks up, and there's some stock footage from like 1910 of chicken hawks flying around in the sky. And Lou just, you know, lifts his gun and shoots. And Bud takes one of the chickens and throws it from the boat to Lou's feet. You know, so he's like, "Yeah, see, I never miss." And he goes, "Watch this." And he shoots twice, and 3 birds fall. <You know? laughs> And it just gets worse from here. The last one he shoots, and it's a bald one that's already been plucked. And he's like, "How do you like that? I scared the feathers out of him." But anyway, they ignore him. They push him aside, and Lou, like, you know, resignedly tosses the guns or moves the guns away, shoots towards Joe Sawyer, who's off camera, and you hear the first of Joe Sawyer's screams. And when you see Joe, his pants are down and he's wearing polka dot long johns. it's that high comedy thing.
Yeah.
makes these films last. So, okay, we're leading up to another one of my favorite scenes. And this is another one. If you're a Three Stooges fan, you know all about it. And I'm sure they did it with Curly at one point, but I remember, is it Shemp? Shemp. Three Hams on Rye, it was called.
Yes.
Right? And yes. It's the same situation. A broken potholder somehow gets onto the layer cake and covered in frosting. And before you know it, everyone eating it is spitting out feathers. And it's very funny. And it's done very well here.
Yes.
This is Felix Adler, of course. And while he's making the cake, that's my favorite part.
Yes.
He's like an artist, you know, with putting the frosting on and then another piece. And, you know, his hands are full of frosting. And at one point he steps back to look at the cake and he puts his hand on his hat. And it's like covered in frosting, you know, fingerprints and stuff. And eventually he brings it out and everybody starts eating it and spitting out feathers. But it's the final scene, the final picture in that bit. Mm-hmm. It's a long shot of the whole room. It's like a shot out of Citizen Kane. You know, you get everything. But it is covered in feathers, people coughing feathers. There must be a million feathers. And it fades out on that. And that's all you need. It was just great. Okay. Well, I got news for you. The next thing is probably why this movie is memorable to most people. And that's because they do what both Jerry and I feel is the very best version of Who's on First.
Oh, yeah.
Now, a lot of people are going to say, no, the TV show in the 50s. I totally disagree. Number one, you didn't need the laughter, you know, behind it. Of course, it was the TV show, so you kind of had to have it. But they also screw up a few times in that version, and I kind of wince sometimes. Mm-hmm. Lou forgets some things, you know, and they are all on the money in this one. It's as close to perfect as you could get. And they are acting like they are just fantastic. They both believe every single word. Now, this was shot twice, and it was in real time, two cameras. The first time, they couldn't use it because the crew was hysterical. The second time, after Gene Yarborough yelled at the crew and said, "You've got to, you know, stop it. Just don't laugh." So they had one wide camera on Lou, because he was like hitting himself on the head with the bat and having to get his hat and all that stuff. And then the classic two shot of the boys. And of course, in the background, and I noticed this maybe last year after watching this movie for maybe 50 years, 60 years, that the backdrop says Patterson on it, you know, Lou's hometown.
Yes.
Anyway, so they do the most perfect version of Who's on First out there. And they told the audience, look like you're laughing, but don't laugh, because they were going to dub it in later. But they decided not to.
Yeah.
But you hear the cameraman laughing. If you put your ear up there, you will hear the laughter.
You got a pitcher on a team?
Wouldn't this be a fine team without a pitcher?
I don't know. Tell me the pitcher's name.
Tomorrow.
You don't want to tell me the date?
I'm telling you, man.
Then go ahead.
Tomorrow.
What time?
What time what?
What time tomorrow you're going to tell me who's pitching?
Now listen, who is not pitching? Who is on?
I'll break your arm. You say who's on first?
That's why I come up here and ask.
I want to know what's the pitcher's name.
What's on second?
I don't know. Third base.
Isn't it great?
And my contention on that is they're on stage. You know, Bud is, you know, Dexter is performing. He's singing Take Me Out to the Ball Game, which is the lead into this whole thing. So they are on a stage with an audience in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
So why not let the live laughter come in, you know?
Because you can't, how can I put this? Like, you can't lasso a hurricane.
Yeah.
You can't control what might happen during that. And they're running it in real time and all that stuff. So I understand why they would do that, and they would rather dub it in. But saner heads prevailed, and they just left it the way it was. And just hearing the cameraman laugh is such a bonus. It's so great. But yeah, I just, you know, I could watch this version of the routine over and over and over again and laugh every single time. That's the thing about Who's on First.
Yes.
I've been watching a lot of the, and Jerry, I think we talked about this. I've been watching people watching Who's on First for the first time. You know what I mean? On YouTube.
Yes.
People in England, people here, and you, I'm shocked to see people going, what is this, Abbott and Costello or something? I don't know. Somebody told me this was funny, so let's put it on. I can't believe how many people don't know this routine and don't know Abbott and Costello, but it never fails, never fails. Yep. They are always at the end. They are, we've got to see more of this, you know, these guys.
And to those who say the television version is better than this one, I'm sorry, this is the version that is playing on a continuous loop at the Baseball Hall of Fame.
Absolutely. And the record is up there on the wall.
Yeah.
And the voice, I think they were more proud of that than anything else.
Yeah.
Being in the Baseball Hall of Fame. I was there recently, 10 years ago, and I was watching the routine, and it was me with a bunch of fathers and their sons watching, mm-hmm. and the sons were young. The sons were bored. I hate to say it, but the kids were a little bored. It was too long for them. They lost it after a while, and the fathers were laughing like crazy, like along with me. But it just goes to show you that what television and internet has done to younger people. They just don't, mm-hmm. they don't have that capacity. They That's don't have okay. that capacity for, you know, hanging on for a long period of time. Give it to me now. You know, microwave comedy. Yeah.
I feel exceptionally blessed in that my son at age 8 or 9 first mm-hmm. came across this routine and just was so enthralled that he wanted to do it. And he learned it, and he and I have performed it a couple of times. So, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's incredible. And you should be very proud of him for that. It shows great intelligence, actually. So anyway, we're finished with Who's on First. I can't say enough about it. And then we cut to the gambling casino on the showboat. And I love bringing this guy up. Tom Fadden is sitting at the poker table. He accuses someone, one of the crooks, of cheating, and he gets shot. Now, it's a flesh wound, but that's Tom Fadden, the first person to get killed by the Blob in the movie The Blob. I think I've said that in like 4 different episodes. Okay. So, this is happening, and it's really getting tense. The Captain Sam is there, and he's like yelling at them, this is the River Queen. You can't do this. You can't. And it gets very tense. But to alleviate that tenseness, we get another scene that is very familiar to Three Stooges fans, especially because it's from a public domain short called mm-hmm. Malice in the Palace. And it's the scene where Larry is cooking up hot dogs and cats for dinner. And Mo and Shemp and Vernon Dent and the other guy are going to be the recipients of this horrible meal. And I'm sure you've seen this. And actually, Curly was supposed to play the chef, but he was too ill. They couldn't make out what he was trying to say because of his stroke. So Larry took over and he played the chef. I like this version better, I have to say. It's got a couple of things working for it. Right? You too, Jerry? You feel that way?
Oh, yeah, I agree. I mean, in the Stooges version, I think the fact that they are dog and cat, you know, hot dogs, and I think rabbit is what they were actually going to mm-hmm. serve.
Yeah.
But, you know, they think that Larry's chopping up a dog and a cat, you know.
Right, right.
But they keep it simple, just the cat, and they reference that it's a catfish.
Right.
That they're actually preparing, you know, the Sam McDaniel is in the kitchen with
Lillian Yarbo. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they're referencing these cats, the cats, as they say, the catfish. Yeah.
Right, right. They shorten it only to torture Lou Costello.
Yes.
So, they're talking about the cats and, you know, we're going to make these. I want one of those cats, you know. And Lou is hearing this from the dining room. He's hearing this in the kitchen. And he's getting scared. He's getting nervous already, especially since the chef comes out. Sam comes out and grabs the cat and brings it into the kitchen, you know, holding it by the scruff of the neck while he's holding a cleaver because the cat is like stealing food and running around. So he brings the cat into the kitchen and, you know, the cat is safe. He puts it away. So They're supposed to have chopped meat, right? Two little patties of chopped meat, two little hamburgers. And Sam brings them out and puts them up, on their plates or on their dinner table. And the cat makes its way under the table. So whenever Lou puts his fork into the meat, the cat goes, meow. And it's very, his pantomime is just, it's so much better than Mo and Shemp. I love Mo and Shemp, but sorry, this is another level. And eventually he pours his milk onto the patty and you hear the cat going, you know, licking it up, and the milk disappears into the meat. It's like, now one of the main reasons this is better than the Stooges is Bud Abbott.
Yes.
Just like with the oyster stew, Bud is absolutely clueless, sitting there watching. It's perfectly good meat. Eat the meat. It's perfectly good. And Lou has a line that I always found curious, but I always loved. He looks at Bud's food, and instead of saying, "Is yours all right?" he says, "Are you going to like yours?" It's like looking into the future, you know? Not yours. It was such a child thing to say, you know? Mm-hmm. So anyway, this goes on, and, you know, he puts the fork in the thing, and the cat is like, you know, whatever. And at the very end, of course, you know, it just goes, it's just pandemonium with the cats jumping up and down and him, you know, hitting the meat and all this stuff. It's a very good scene. It's a very funny scene. And if you're a student of comedy, you know, hold it up against the Stooges. Maybe you'll like the Stooges better.
Yeah.
But I love Bud's dialogue during this scene. You've got to eat something. What, cats? You know, he's completely clueless. And since when do they drink milk? They don't look like milk drinkers to me.
No, no.
And I love when Lou is petting the meat patty and you hear... Oh, God. It really is great stuff. Okay. And then there's another bit. See, this movie is just one bit after another.
Yes.
The fishing scene, right? They're on the deck fishing. Mm-hmm. And Lou's got his pole in the water and Bud's got his... And he's putting his bait on the hook, and it's an apple.
What are you using for bait?
Apple?
Suppose he used a worm.
The worm is in the apple.
Go ahead.
Which makes perfect sense to me. You know, the worm's in the apple. So what this is basically is Lou keeps catching a big fish, and the fish get bigger and bigger and bigger, and he keeps throwing them back as bait, so he'll get an even bigger fish. And there is an outtake. I love to mention these outtakes because they're so funny and dirty. They're doing the thing, and Lou's pulling up the fish, and Bud's saying, "Pull it in, pull it in, pull it in." Lou looks at his crotch and says, "Is it out?" It's very funny. A little dirty, but very funny. So anyway, he has this enormous fish. He throws it in, and the pole takes Lou into the water with the fish. And Bud, you know, his pal, throws him a ring, you know, what do you call it? And it's attached to a rope, and he starts, you know, using the winch to pull Lou up. And Lou is... He's got the thing tied around his stomach, so he's folded in half being pulled up. But he notices, as he's pulled up, very Harpo Marx-like in A Night at the Opera, he sees into the porthole of the room of the villains, and he hears them planning. So once he gets up, he tells Bud, he says, "Hey, lower me down. I can hear what they're saying down there." All right. So it just so happens at this point that Joe Sawyer is shaving. And he's got, you know, he's putting the cream on his face and they're talking, you know, whatever. Lou goes down into the porthole on the other side of the porthole, and they do their version of the mirror scene.
Mm-hmm.
This is interesting because no one ever topped the Marx Brothers in Duck Soup. That is the gold standard of mirror scenes. It was done by Max Linder back in the silent days. It was done by Chaplin and The Floor Walker in 1916. You know, so it's not a new bit. But the thing that gets me about this one is that it could have been so much better. And I'll tell you why. This is where my comedy writing comes in. Mm-hmm. Lou looks nothing like Joe Sawyer.
Right.
All right. And he's really not making exactly the same moves and whatever that would make it believable that Joe Sawyer would be taken in with this. Mm-hmm. Well, had they established maybe that he has a seeing problem, maybe he needs his glasses or something like that, or maybe he was drinking or something along those lines as an impediment mm-hmm. to, you know, this very obvious contrived situation.
Yes.
Now it's fun. It's a lot of fun and it's cute. And Lou is very funny when he, you know, he moves his head over and hits his head on the side of the wall. That's very funny. But the main reason for this bit, and I scream, I laugh all the time when Joe Sawyer turns around and he can't believe what he's seeing. And then he turns around for the last time and there's Lou's butt in full form right there at the porthole. And that's what Joe Sawyer is looking into. And of course we get his take and that fades out at that point. So it's a very cute scene. You have to leave your believability meter at the door, mm-hmm. but yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's cute. I just have to say two things during the fishing scene. When yes. Lou is pulling in the big fish, he starts singing, which I love.
Yes, and, yes.
And Bud saying, when the fish hits the boat, what are you trying to do, break the boat? He only cares about the stuff that might cost him money.
Yeah. what are you doing?
All right. So one of my favorite scenes is coming up. And I say that about a lot of these bits, but mm-hmm. I left out one that is just, to me, I can't help it. I think it's one of their best routines, and that's the singing bit.
Yes.
That's where Lou finally gets the chance to sing a song in the show, and he wants to rehearse it. But while he's rehearsing, behind him, Bud is giving directions to a stagehand that we don't see, and he's adjusting all the scenery as Lou is trying to sing. Now, Lou is singing,
My body lies over the ocean.
And while Bud is saying things like, higher, lift it higher, you know, my body lies over, no, higher. And he's talking to the guy backstage. Lou thinks he's talking to him. And of course, at the very end, he leads him into falling into the orchestra pit. When he tells him to get low all the way down to the floor, I scream. It is just so funny. Oh my God. It's so fun. And lift both legs and he has to like jump up and down. Now, one of the reasons I love this scene so much is that Bud is supposed to be an old hand at, you know, being an actor. And here he is playing stage, you know, manager. And you assume he knows what he's doing. He's giving directions on something a 9-year-old would be able to describe to somebody backstage. Okay, put the two side pieces down and then the back down. That'll be great. Perfect. Instead, it's like this whole thing that he's lifting things up. He's making them down. He's doing everything but what he should be doing. But nobody yeah. notices that. You know, they're just looking at Lou, you know, mishearing what Bud is saying. But anyway, that's one of my all-time favorite bits and probably the second funniest bit in the movie behind Who's On First for mm-hmm. me. Anyway.
Yeah.
So here's the scene where I did mention that they said that Joe Sawyer's character has nightmares.
Yes.
I mentioned that. Well, this is where it comes into play. He has Cap'n Sam's IOU in his wallet. Bud and Lou sneak into his room while he's asleep, and they start looking around. And, of course, Lou picks up a vase at one point and doesn't even look at Bud. He throws it over his shoulder, and Bud has to catch it before it hits the floor. It's a really sweet bit. So they're looking, and all of a sudden, Joe Sawyer is really having one of his crazy dreams. Where is that Indian? I must find that Indian. I must tell the general. And he's walking around and where is that little Indian? And of course he thinks Lou is the Indian mm-hmm. and he beats the crap out of him. and every time he leaves him in this horrible position, he turns to us and says, this I must tell to the general. And he goes back to bed. Well, they start looking around the room again, and all of a sudden, where is that Indian? I know he's hiding. And it goes on this way. And Bud is pushing Lou towards him, going, it's him. There he is. He's right here. He's pushing him into it. And he's just beating up Lou and all this. And it finally ends where they don't get the wallet, but he ends up kicking Joe Sawyer into a trunk and closing it and saying to us, of course, tell that to the general. And he runs out. And that's the end, the end of the scene. It's a great, really great routine. And I'm surprised they never did it again. You know,
that's
another one of those that I think they missed out on because it's just so funny. And Joe Sawyer, he's having the time of his life. You know it. You just feel it. It's just fantastic. Okay. Lois Collier, who could use a sandwich. She is so skinny. You know, I want to throw her some like mozzarella. Here, eat this. Eat this, Lois. Anyway, so she sings I Can't Get You Out of My Mind, written by Jack Brooks and Edgar Fairchild. Apparently Edgar Fairchild, this was his biggest hit, and it wasn't really a hit. So sorry, Edgar. And as she's singing, there is this amazing panning shot of the gambling room. It goes on forever. It's like a Martin Scorsese panning shot. You know, it doesn't cut. And it takes us right up to the stage where she's singing. It's just great. It really is great. And it's a really sweet song. Let's hear a little bit of that song.
I can't get you out of my mind. My one thought is you. And somehow I find that I can't keep you out of my dreams. You're here, you're there, you're everywhere, or so it seems. I can't get you out of my heart. You're right there to stay, and though we're apart, you left so many memories behind. That I can't get you out of my mind. No, I can't get you out of my mind.
And I think we mentioned that the chorus boys behind her looked like they were applying for Social Security. I can't get you out of my mind. I'm surprised you can get anything in your mind other than senility. You know, God, these guys are so old. I guess the guys weren't home from overseas yet.
Yeah.
So anyway, she sings and Alan Curtis he's in love with her. He falls in love with her. And he decides he's going to help her out and he's going to double cross the double crossers. I thought that was very interesting that they cheat to get back at the cheaters, basically.
Yeah.
I did want to mention one thing, though, Jerry, and I hope you won't hold this against me, but our good friend Kevin Brownlow found a clip, very rare clip, one that was never released. You've heard of the Lux Radio Theater of the
Air?
Yes. Yeah. Cecil B. DeMille hosted it for most of its run. By this time, it was William Dieterle was running it, you know, the director at Warner Brothers. And they did the radio version of It's a Wonderful Life. And Jimmy Stewart was all set to do it. In fact, he was a neighbor of Bud's. But Jimmy fell ill. And he couldn't think at the last minute of anyone to ask. So he went over to his friends, Betty and Bud Abbott. And he said, well, Bud, certainly I will. Sure, yes. So we have a clip of It's a Wonderful Life. It was never shown. Bud didn't have enough rehearsal time and they didn't know about his penchant for ad-libbing. So let's hear this little thing around this holiday season. One of the great holiday movies of all time. It's a Wonderful Life, starring Bud Abbott as George Bailey.
George Bailey, you once called me a warped, frustrated old man. Well, what are you but a warped, frustrated young man? Quiet! What are you doing? I don't care that you're sitting down. Take that, you crazy nut!
Okay, now it goes over to... It's clipping over to the ending scene. Hold on one second. To my brother, George Bailey, the richest man in town.
What do you mean, richest man in town? Didn't you see my tax bill? I'm losing everything. This is crazy.
But father, teacher says that every time a bell rings, an angel gets his wings.
Don't you believe that stuff? What are you talking about? No wonder we're broke all the time. What? Get out of here, Zuzu. What are you, nuts? This is
And that's all we have. But boy, I would have loved to hear that whole thing, you know?
Uncle Henry, are you okay? I'm all right, George. I'm all right.
Okay, I think we can move on now. But thank you to Kevin Brown, though. Yes?
All I have to say is, if these clips are so rare, how does Kevin Brownlow find them in the first place? And then my second question is, why does Kevin Brownlow find them?
Oh, my God. And I only chose Kevin Brownlow because people know who he is, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Otherwise, you know, it could be like Phil Schmoidman.
Exactly.
But it isn't. It's not Phil Schmoidman. Okay. So here we go. Whew. They do a scene now. This is one of my problems with this movie.
Yes.
They do a scene now where they Lou is under the table, under the roulette table, and he's got the magnet this time. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to win the money to pay off, you know, what they owe on the boat so they can get rid of the villains. So he gets a little too greedy, and he tries to take the chips from Joe Sawyer's hands on his magnet, and the chase is on. Now, this could have been the finale of the film.
Mm-hmm.
You could have moved the whole card game where they win back the boat and blah, 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 and then go right into a chase. But what they do is they run after Lou, and Sam McDaniel is standing on the deck. And when Lou runs by, he hits Sam McDaniel, and Sam falls into the water. Bud, being very un-Bud-like, says,
"Don't worry, Sebastian, I'll save you."
And he jumps into the water. So you've got Sam McDaniel and Bud Abbott in the water, and Lou's not even there. So he runs back, and he sees them both floundering in the water. And Bud, of course, yells,
"Throw me a lifesaver!"
Well, let's go back to Horse Feathers. And in 1932. And I can't imagine that even that was the first time they used that joke. You know what I mean? It's just such an obvious joke. But they do. Lou takes out a pack of lifesavers and throws him one. And that's the end. But instead, we get another finale. And this is where they cheat the cheaters. And Alan Curtis does it. He goes against his former employees. We've learned that he was taken in, like Captain Sam was. So he's not really a member of the triumvirate. Yeah, so this is what happens. They win. Captain Sam wins. They cheated. They run after Lou and Bud for some reason when it's Alan Curtis who, you know, did the cheating. But good old Alan Curtis, just as the chase is starting, he gets a good punch to the jaw, and that's the last time we see him. Some hero. So they're after Bud and Lou, and this starts the chase around the deck. And when I was a kid, this was my favorite part. I loved it. It was like a Bugs Bunny cartoon.
Oh, yeah.
All the gags, right? So they're running around the deck. Joe Sawyer is running with a bunch of his thugs. And at one point, Bud tells Lou, "Get them to chase you. I'll come out and hit them on the head, okay?" And this is all from Spite Marriage with Buster Keaton, actually, from 1929.
Yep.
But anyway, they do that. And eventually, you know, they win the day. There is one Harold Lloyd gag that it went unnoticed. Let's put it that way. Lou is standing in a corner on the deck, looking very sheepish. And Joe Sawyer finds him. He's got a metal bar in his hand, and he hits Lou on the head as hard as he can. And you hear the bang, but Lou doesn't flinch. So he takes it again. He turns it around, and he hits him again. Bang! Lou doesn't flinch. And Joe Sawyer's wondering, and then Lou runs away, and you see he's standing by a pipe that is right over his head, and that's taking the brunt of the hit. So it's the kid brother with Harold Lloyd. That gag was quite prominent. But anyway, they got away with that one. So the chase ends. The crooks are arrested. They're put in. They're taken out of town. Alan Curtis gets to stay, and you know, with Lois Collier, and Lou gets his dream of acting in Uncle Tom's Cabin. And of course, he plays Little Eva, dressed in a nightdress with a wig, a bad blonde wig. And Bud is, it looks like he's Simon Legree. He's got the whip. And,
yes, you know, it does. He's got the mustache to twirl and, yeah, the whole nine yards.
I'll bet he was a good Simon Legree. But they're singing a song, Eva's going up to heaven, 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 Eva's going. And, of course, the rope breaks and Lou falls through the stage to the bottom. And there is this great shot of from above.
Yes.
Looking down the hole, straight down at him. And he's looking right up at us. And he just says, I think I went in the wrong direction. The end. An excellent way to end. He got his dream of being in the show. Yep. And everybody's happy except the two that are going to jail. So, yeah, that's it. That is the Naughty 90s. Always a favorite of mine. And like I said earlier on, this was sort of a turning point. This was the last typical, and it's not really typical. It's a costume picture. It's a period picture.
Yes.
And they never made one before. This is their first.
This is their first, yeah.
Yeah. So that's a first for them. And again, this is preceding another trip to MGM. Mm-hmm. Making probably my favorite of the three films they made at MGM. And that's Abbott and Costello in Hollywood. Not a great one, but it is my favorite of the three. So, Jerry, we will meet in a couple of weeks to discuss MGM and all that entails. And I want to thank you for another elucidating hour and a half. That was fantastic.
Whoa, elucidating. We're getting out the big guns now. Okay.
Wait, well, I think... aren't they taking that out of the water? Oh, no, wait, that's fluoride. Okay.
Exactly, yeah. I do want to say, for the benefit of our listeners, you know, if you all ever want to follow along in all of this, there's a great book that you can get your hands on. Mm-hmm. It's called The Annotated Abbott and Costello.
Aww.
Written by Matthew Conium and some other guy.
John Landis.
John Landis, yes, that's right. Yeah, he does the foreword, and I don't know how you managed to grab John Landis to do the foreword for this book, but it's nicely written.
Around the waist, he was less ticklish there.
There you are. Okay.
But yeah, he was kind enough to do our foreword, and I also wanted to mention where you could see these films. There is a DVD and a Blu-ray version of all of their Universal films in one package. And it's probably my go-to DVD experience, Blu-ray experience, most often. And you could go to Warner Archive and look for Abbott and Costello, Meet Captain Kidd, Rio Rita. And there is a release of three comedy teams on one disc or two discs. And that's Abbott and Costello, The Three Stooges, and Laurel and Hardy. Mm-hmm. Now, they use MGM stuff mostly, and you can see Abbott and Costello in Hollywood and Lost in a Harem on this collection. That's for sale at Amazon.
Yeah.
Our book is for sale from McFarland Publishing, and I think that about covers it, I think. What do you got up, Jerry? Anything?
Well, actually, we'll be trotting the boards after the first of the year.
Wonderful.
I just got hired. One of our local universities makes a habit of casting primarily students in their productions, but they all often hire a, for lack of a better term, professional actor
from the
community. Yeah, to take on one of the roles. And it's a teaching experience as well. So, giving the students an opportunity to work with different people with different experiences. So I will be in a production of Something Rotten.
Ooh, which is a very funny show. Yeah, and you'll be wonderful in it. Oh, boy. I'm jealous. but that's great. That is a very funny show. You're going to have a great time.
Yeah.
Yay. Okay. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening. I'm really loving the numbers on our podcasts. And... I'm just keep coming back and tell your friends about it. And I know it's kind of egghead stuff, as far as the movies and everything and what goes on behind the scenes. But, you know, we're trying to make it, we try to keep it light and user friendly. Let's put it that way.
Yes.
So, yeah. So keep using us, and we will see you next time with Abbott and Costello in Hollywood. Thanks.